Ashcroft and the others around him clearly would like a very powerful state which will work for the rich and will control the population and impose discipline on them in every imaginable way.
I think the initiative process is a very good way of creating a community and of getting people out and mobilized and organized.
It is our responsibility to take on the mantle of citizenship even more, that we have to, in any sense, talk about this.
One of the most dangerous aspects of the tragedy of September 11th is that it allowed an undemocratic and totalitarian segment of the political right to cement policies against civil and immigrant rights that had long been in the works, even before 9/11.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, May 16th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Stepping up the pressure for a vote next week, the United States presented a revised resolution to the UN Security Council to immediately lift sanctions against Iraq, but Russia and China signaled today they still want major changes. Russian Foreign Minister Yuri Fedotov told the Interfax news agency after meeting China's Deputy Foreign Minister Yang Wenchang that both countries believe that provisions in this draft resolution require serious amendments. Well, up to 30,000 top members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party will be banned from any future Iraqi government, a senior U.S. official said today, as part of a sweeping decree aimed at putting a stake in the heart of the long-entrenched organization, quote-unquote. The order, the latest salvo in what is becoming an increasingly high-profile battle by American occupying forces against remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime, will not be easy to carry out. The talent pool of the Iraqi civil service is brimming with bureaucrats whose livelihoods depended on Ba'ath Party affiliation. General Tommy Franks, the U.S. top military officer in Iraq, announced on the new U.S.-sponsored radio station in Iraq recently that the Ba'ath Party had been dissolved. Despite the apparent dissolution of the party, many of its members continue to play key roles in the post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. Pacifica correspondent Aaron Glantz has more in this report.
Mohammed cries as he looks at the names on the wall of the Free Prisoners Committee, a group of survivors of Saddam Hussein's prisons who are publishing as best they can the records of those killed by Saddam Hussein. Mohammed has just learned both of his brothers were executed by Saddam's Ba'ath Party in 1983 for being members of the Islamic Dawah Party. The last time he saw them, he was 13 years old. After the American Army occupied Baghdad, the military banned the Ba'ath Party. But here at the Free Prisoners Committee, the Ba'ath is still very much a reality. Mohammed Nouri Abdul Hussein Al-Jari guards the committee's building. He served 3 years in prison under Saddam Hussein for deserting the army during the Iran-Iraq War.
We've been attacked 4 times by the Ba'ath Party. One time we found a car with a bomb across the street, but we called the coalition forces and they defused it.
But while the American army takes on the Ba'ath Party in the streets, the Bush administration's civil administrators in Iraq are moving to employ former Ba'athists in many top jobs. The first judge appointed by the Americans, for example, Ibrahim Malik al-Hindawi, is the same man who was president of the Iraqi court when Saddam Hussein was president of the country. He was asked if his connections to the old dictatorial regime create an injustice in Iraq's justice system.
The criminal law is applied according to its detailed items. As to whether the law is applied justly, the judge cannot be asked if he is just or not.
This policy of putting former Ba'athists in key posts upsets many of Washington's allies. Fawzi Hariri is deputy director of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which has administered parts of northern Iraq under American auspices since the 1991 Gulf War.
It indicates a lack of expertise and knowledge of these individuals and personalities. It seems that the present information that some of the people operating in Iraq are extremely superficial, There are many of the former Ba'athist employees are being brought back in again when we have 4 million Iraqi expats with wealth of experience in not only in their fields but also in democratic processes that could be employed in their position. However, there is that trend of employing existing or former general managers, senior executives that operated under the last government.
In the meantime, it seems, Iraqis may be taking their own revenge against the Ba'athists. 2 days ago, two people shot the new jailer in the southern city of Kut. The jailer was a familiar face in Kut. The man hired to run the jail by the Americans had been a mid-ranking Ba'athist in Saddam's regime. For Pacificus Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
MCI has come under pressure recently to sever ties with actor and political activist Danny Glover because of his opposition to the war on Iraq and more recently for his signing a petition in support of Fidel Castro. That's according to the Washington Times newspaper. Glover has appeared in a number of television commercials for MCI's long-distance phone service. He is one of 160 artists and celebrities, including Harry Belafonte, who signed a letter addressed to, quote, the conscience of the world, end quote, asking the U.S. to respect the sovereignty of Cuba. Earlier this year, Glover called President Bush racist and more recently signed a letter saying the U.S. government's harassment against Cuba could serve as a pretext for an invasion. That's according to Fox News 23. Fox also reported Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch, a conservative right-wing Washington public interest group, called for a boycott of MCI, saying, quote, MCI must fire Glover. They can't have a spokesman supporting terrorist Castro any more than it should have a spokesman supporting Osama bin Laden, end quote. Peace Watch spoke to Glover today, and he set the record straight about his relationship with MCI and the motivations for his most recent political actions.
The whole issue that we're dealing with in terms of really creating a real space where we are able to hear people's voices and also honor their dissent is something we're going to be talking about for a long time, and particularly in this critical moment in this country's history, in the world's history.
Yes, indeed. MCI has been attacked or approached, or there's an attempt to influence MCI mm-hmm. to have them distance themselves from commercial agreement that you have with them. Can you just sort of summarize what the status of that is?
Let me get this clear, because there's a whole argument that I've signed some sort of contract to act as a spokesman for MCI. Like most artists do commercials, mm-hmm. MCI contacted me and asked me if I would do some spots. And I quoted them a price that I thought was fair, and my agents, rather, and then we did those spots. Now, those spots were aired. They aired, and they were very successful. If the spots had not been successful, then it's a moot point. We're not talking now. But the spots were very successful. People liked the spots. MCI, which had its own issues and problems, and were trying to, from my understanding, from all indications from people I talked to in the progressive community, were trying to deal with them, felt good about it, mm-hmm. and came back to me and asked me to do some additional spots. Initially, it would be 6 spots. It would ultimately end up being 8 spots. Well, we did 5 of those spots, and we're on slate to do the other 3. From my understanding, mm-hmm. MCI has not contacted me and told me anything to the contrary. So the next thing that happened was that apparently, and I don't even know, some right-wing pundit, some fascist pundit, at some point in time suggested or started a campaign to have MCI dropped the commercials and so on because of my opposition to the war, because maybe my attack on the Bush administration or whatever it was, for whatever mm-hmm. reason. It could be for anything. I mean, it could have been from last year, a year and a half ago, when I gave a speech at Princeton about the death penalty. So the issue is not MCI per se. So this whole thing, what we were able to do is to use this attack and attempt to undermine my right to speak out in dissent as a way of galvanizing people and organizing people around it. Mm-hmm. And that's as simply as it. You know, this is not about saving my job at MCI or whatever. I have no job at MCI.
Mm-hmm.
This is about us talking about how do we begin to say that in a climate of fear and intimidation, how do we stand up and say we're not going to stand for it?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about. And the dial-in for democracy is an idea by primarily Bill Fletcher, who's the president of Trans Africa Forum, to focus in on this. Because the issue is not dial in to get Danny's job back. The issue is dial in for democracy.
And for free speech.
And for free speech.
So the chilling political climate that we're in at this time in our history, when an American citizen should have to even face public condemnation from a narrow but influential sector of society for expressing his or her political views. It's kind of hard to believe this is America. Are you surprised at the vindictive response to your political views?
Not at all. I think this is the history of this. And I think we have amnesia when it comes to history. You know, that the McCarthy era in the 50s was a similar period. So there's always a tendency to do this, you know, particularly when you see the state of the world. What you have here is an incredible uprising among people just to define and say that we're gonna have a voice in what happens to us. What has happened to us, and particularly Americans, is that we've been separated from that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that people around the world, you look at the race. Whatever you talk about hunger in the world, you talk about poverty in the world, all those are on uprising. You talk about conflicts in the world, all those are on uprising. And all that is happening. So what is happening essentially is that the response to that in any situation, and particularly when it comes to people who speak out domestically, I mean, they have ways of handling those people who speak out abroad, you know, but people who speak out domestically, those are the ones that you have to begin to crush.
Hmm.
So this is not anything that's new, a different kind of response by this government.
It's clearly not.
It's happened so many times before. Found in the 50s at the same time that we were talking about in the late 40s after war, people started a peace movement, an anti-fascist movement. You know, the Dixiecrats were organizing for state rights. And state right means that we have the right to lynch black people if we want to lynch them.
Hmm.
So you find that in the 50s. This is consistent, which led into the McCarthy era. You know, we have to believe that no matter what the technology and whatever the glowing words of all the great documents that have been written, that this country has not lived out those documents,
mm-hmm.
has not lived out those documents. And we have to hold them accountable to that.
There are some who have said, Danny Glover, that what we're going through now, this political climate, is far more chilling than the McCarthy era, in as much as the McCarthy era was spearheaded by the senator. At the same time, this seems to be coming from a higher echelon throughout the government itself, the White House, the administration, as well as the Homeland Security Acts, that the Patriot Act that was passed, the far-reaching effect that's having on almost reverting the civil liberties that we have in this country.
What I think is important to understand is that people talk about cycles, and I don't believe in the idea of cycles. There were very incredible things that are happening in the world in the 1950s, and most of us know our history. In the World War II, you had an incredible fragmentation in the world, and on a very unsettled world. You had people demanding for national liberation, whether they're Chinese, or whether they're Africans, or whether they're Guatemalans, or whatever. You had people making demands for national liberation and the right for self-determination. Those things were important. You were on the verge of this incredible technological revolution that was happening in the world. Those were the realities that were happening in the world at that particular point in time. And you had one country with it basically been unscathed by the war, which came out in whole, the only country in the world that came out whole at the end of World War II. So all of that is, and the most powerful, at that time, the most powerful country in the world. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have, on the one hand, the kind of dialogue or the friction between communism, ideological friction. You don't have that. That's not a reality anymore. But what you do have is this incredible technology and this incredible arrogance that is happening, and to crush people and to submit people. We saw what happened in the attempted buyout of poor countries in order to get them to get on board in terms of this war. We saw all of that. You see all of the buyout that's happening. And just because we have more SUVs and greater technology and everything else, it still doesn't underline the fact. It still does not crush the reality that there's some real major issues in terms of happening in this world. Real issues in terms of real democracy, real major issues in terms of sustainability, real issues in terms of people having a voice in terms of what is happening in their lives, a direct voice in terms of what's happening in their lives.
And Mr. Glover, when you speak of people having a voice, there are some individuals who would seem to suggest or insist that individuals in high profile positions such as yourself, individuals who are actors or actresses seem to have no right, or they try to say that you have no right to speak out. We saw what happened to the Dixie Chicks lead singer and the filmmaker Michael Moore, who was booed at the Academy Awards ceremony. There's a mindset that people of your position and your profile and your status have no right to speak out, no rights, individual rights. What's your response to that?
Well, I think in one sense we have a greater obligation, a greater responsibility to speak out. It is our responsibility to take on the mantle of citizenship even more, that we have to, in any sense, talk about this. What I say is not going to change people's mind. Perhaps what it would do is lead people to other information that ultimately change their mind about what they see and what they believe. And that's important. The fact that we speak out at this particular point, and you could say that certainly we're put in a position where we perhaps lose our ability to make a living. But the fact that we speak out perhaps gives other people in other places a platform to speak out. The fact that we speak out in some ways provides a road, an avenue for people who are not as visible with us, who do not have, who are immersed in this kind of fear, to speak out.
And at the same time, this backlash, this right-wing nationalistic sort of backlash, seems to even extend to individuals who are not in the limelight. There's a woman in Mondovi, Wisconsin, which is a town of about population 2,500, who hung an American flag upside down in her window and was subjected to constant harassment by many of the people in the town, and eventually her apartment lease was not renewed. And there's the story of a man wearing a T-shirt with the message "Peace on Earth" who was arrested in a shopping mall outside Albany, New York.
And issue with immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, what's happening with immigrants in here? People of South Asian descent, people of Islamic descent. That's happening too. People who are the other. So I think there's a climate here, and it's a very frightening climate. And the thing is about it is that the tools of suppression are much more refined than they were 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so is it fair to say, Danny Glover, that's why you are so committed to speaking your truth?
I'm committed to talking and creating a public dialogue about what's happening in the world. I'm the chairman of the board of Trans Africa, and I took on the chairmanship of the board in order that African Americans can become a part of the arena in discussions about foreign policy, particularly when it comes to Africa and the diaspora, the Caribbean and South America. And it's critical that we talk about this, because we may find that some of the new wars that we talk about, some of the new wars that we'll be asked to support will be in those very places. There's oil in the Gulf of Guinea, and it's a major, major oil. There's been conflicts, and this is not something new to me. I mean, I've been involved. I was involved with African Liberation Support Committee 30 years ago. I mean, I just don't come to the table just because I've had some sort of visibility at this particular point in my life. I come to the table because those are the issues that I've been concerned about all my life, mm-hmm. all my adult life. You know, there are many of us who were protesting the end of apartheid when we were students 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not. So I'm going to get. I'm as part of us to have a part of be a part of the debate and to make sure that there's a public debate about these issues. Whether those issues, domestic issues around domestic policy, or whether issues around foreign policy as well.
Do you think the average American understands the severity of what is taking place now with regard to civil liberties?
I don't want to undermine what the average American, and I don't know if I could say what the average American. I know we have the capacity to understand. I know that more than a million people mobilized, millions of people mobilized against the war around the world, and millions of people in this country. Against around the world, you know, so I know we have the capacity. Why can't we? You know, we have to. It's our lives, not only our lives, it's our responsibility. Our responsibility, as June Jordan said, we are the ones we are waiting for.
Danny Glover, acclaimed actor, political activist, and chairman of the board of directors of the Trans Africa Forum.
They cut off my voice,
so I grew into voices
into different times.
My songs I pulled.
They cut off my voice,
so I grew into voices
into different times.
My songs I pulled.
They took away my sound.
Two brand new sons, like resplendent drums, I am playing. Today I am playing. Isolated I was from all my people. Isolated I was from all my people. My twin songs are returning like in an echo. And despite the darkness of this exile, my voice set fire against the
cut off my voice,
so I grew two voices
into different times.
My songs I pulled.
They cut off my voice,
so I grew two voices
into different times.
My songs I pulled.
My songs I pulled.
My songs I pulled.
My songs
I
pulled.
My songs
I pulled.
The music of Sweet Honey in the Rock, The Song of the Exiled by Alicia Portnoy, arranged by Isai Barnwell. Well, while outspoken celebrities like Danny Glover, Susan Sarandon, and Michael Moore have experienced harassment and media blackouts for expressing their political views, there's another group of Americans whose voices have also been silenced. In the wake of September 11th, many immigrants found themselves targeted by the FBI and immigration authorities, and they often experience profiling, detentions, and even deportations, according to Sanena Mara, who works with the South Asian Center at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. She spoke recently at a conference in Boston.
One of the most dangerous aspects, as I think we all agree, of the tragedy of September 11th is that it created a climate of such intense fear and vulnerability in the American public that it allowed an undemocratic and totalitarian segment of the political right to cement policies against civil and immigrant rights that had long been in the work, as all our speakers have pointed out, even before 9/11. And it appears, of course, again, not news, that we're in the midst of a civil rights crisis in this country, with the aggressive frontal assault on civil liberties and the Bill of Rights launched by the Bush-Ashcroft regime. And yet, the most frightening aspect of this crisis is that many seem unaware of this. And for many, life continues as usual. And this is why I think there are some people who are not in the room today, right? For example, I heard of a fellow scientist recently at MIT across the river who had not heard of the Patriot Act last month. He had not heard of it, okay? Now, perhaps I should have known that there are people out there who are oblivious even to the first Patriot Act, not even the son of Patriot. But I was even more stunned. You know why? Because he He's South Asian. He's the children of South Asian immigrants who came to this country not that long ago. And I think this speaks to a particular problem in the South Asian, and maybe Mary and I have been talking, maybe even in the Arab American community, that I think we need to think about, and I want to return to this later. But there are those, of course, and you are here among those, who are aware that there has been a curtailment of civil liberties in the name of national security and have heard of the Patriot Act, but there are also some who've quietly accepted this and the realization that indeed civil liberties have to be traded, presumably in the name of our national security. And then there are others who I think are just unaffected by the changes in the law, who are not being targeted by the FBI or the newly recreated Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services, and who continue with their lives as if it's business as usual. But then there are the others, the other half of society who are being targeted, interviewed, arrested, harassed, tortured, deported, and disappeared. These people also live in fear, afraid of going to work if they are undocumented, afraid of being targeted by the FBI if they are Muslim, afraid of being linked to terrorism if they donated money to Palestinian refugees, as we heard, afraid of being arrested without charges or on secret evidence and being removed from their families for months on end, without being afraid of being rounded up for the next war if they happen to be from that nation, afraid of living in the U.S., and afraid of not being able to get asylum in Canada. There are hundreds of Pakistanis sitting in tents on the Canadian border trying to get asylum. As you know, at least 1,200 men are locked up in jails in New Jersey and have been there since 9/11 without any evidence that they were linked to charges of terrorism. They're simply hostages for the public sense of security. The fear of becoming one of the disappeared, of being detained without any information being passed on to one's families, of having wives and children and relatives not able to support themselves in the U.S. has instilled a deep fear in many immigrants, not just Arab or Muslim Americans, that this too could happen to them. So perhaps, I'm thinking, we now live as two nations under Ashcroft. Two nations living in fear, one segment of the population not directly affected by the legislation and either afraid of terrorism and willing to have the crackdown on civil rights or uneasy about the crisis but not sure what to do about it or unaware and unconcerned. The second is directly affected or thinks they may be affected by the changes in the law, but they are also afraid of terrorism, afraid of living their lives, uneasy about the crisis but not sure what to do about it. So as the story about this Indian-American scientist makes clear, I think these two nations are not necessarily divided by race and ethnicity, and I think this is a difficult issue we need to think about. There are South Asian Americans, maybe even Arab Americans, in the first category who believe they're not affected by the post-9/11 laws or are willing to accept that a little racial profiling will bring them security. That's a certain kind of denial that I've encountered as well. And I had a conversation like this last fall at Logan Airport in Boston when I was with two other women, and we were all asked to take off our shoes as part of the "you shall make sure to wear your nice socks" policy. And that's what I call it. I always wear nice socks now. And the South Asian woman with me said she was really grateful about what we were going through because it would make her feel safer. And I told her that feel was really the important word, that this was being done to create a sense of psychological security, and perhaps this is what matters. Needless to say, she was not pleased with me. She was like, where does this woman come from? But clearly, there are in fact brown people who look Arab and who think either that this is a good thing or that they will not be hauled off a plane and they will not be thrown into prison themselves. So these two nations, though, I think are sometimes divided along the lines of class, because it is often South Asian professionals and elites in this country who are in denial about racial profiling that has targeted hundreds of other South Asians by now and who are confident that they can afford a good lawyer to help them if they ever need one. There are also people who think they belong to one nation and they find they belong to another. Filipino Americans laid off from their jobs at Logan Airport, Cambodians being deported due to changes in asylum law, Latinos who look like Arab Americans, and other groups who are not immune from the sweeping powers appropriated by the state after 9/11.
Sunaina Mara worked at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst's English department and at the South Asian Center. She spoke at a recent conference at UMass Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Special thanks to Mark Weaver at community radio station WMBR for production assistance with that piece. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we return, we'll hear from renowned author, intellectual Noam Chomsky. We'll be right back.